You're ready to go home. You know, in ancient times, it would be exactly at this point that we would persevere. It's exactly where we would begin to be tired that the real teaching would begin. Exactly then. Everything else would be just prelude. And in ancient times, that's when you sweep the books to the floor and you take the gloves off. Because exactly at that threshold that you're trying to regress. You're trying to get back into the comfortable world. And it's exactly at that point that the old tradition was to make or break the person now. And the attitude was, frankly, in our American lingual, ruthless. You think that you can find yourself? How about this? Without the Mae West Buster or something on the end to soften it. Yeah. But let me just finish this and then we will take our break. The image exists in language only when the mind is mythically subsumed. Only when the mind is mythically subsumed can the mind be said to be mirror-like. Now the whole secret of the doubling phenomenon is tied up in this kind of a condition. Notice that the doubling phenomenon, the mirror image, is a projected image of the polarized condition, the ultimate goal of the transformation sequence. So that the mirror image, in a way, is symbolic of that transformational objective. And you can get caught, there's a lot of interplay in this, and it's very difficult to keep track of it, because it's not only a mirror image, but there's a full quaternary operating. It's not only the mirror opposite, but it's the upside down of that image and the inside out of that image. So you have four aspects going on. You have a double mirror in the full sphere. In the spiritual trigonometry of that process, it's a full card game. There's four players always, at every point, every condition. And just to be worried about the mirror is the least of your worries. Because the mirror will do in polarity to you whatever you do. And so people become very clever and they think, oh, well, I can handle this. And meanwhile, the other axis, the other polarity, runs wild with your life. That's when you find the children of the minister the worst demons on the block. He forgot the full process and all of the unconscious transferences or go to the children, and they get fed a steady diet of demonic energy. Steady diet. Language, in this way, is the mirror. Language is the mirror. On the mythological horizon, language is the mirror. That is to say, mythology is, in this way, a mirror of the culture. When you understand a people's mythology, it's like you're looking at, in a mirror, the mirror image of that culture. That's the relationship that they have. Mythology and culture have that. Notice here that there's a problem if the way out of that conundrum is ethnocentrically oriented. You have a real conundrum then, because if you use the mythology, which mirrors the culture, and you're using an ethnocentric conditioned way out of that, you can get caught into a dull round, a very large dull round, and never know it. Never know it. So somebody like Joseph Campbell was caught in this kind of a huge web. And it's just very, very, very difficult. It's hard to tell someone like that that this isn't heaven, because they've reached this kind of an equilibrium where it seems that they're at home with, especially if your culture is a new planetary culture, and your mythology is the mirror of that new planetary culture, and your way out seems to be conditioned by the ethnocentricity of that new planetary culture, well, that would be a jail that man wouldn't break out of for another 1,000 years. If it's not broken now, it wouldn't be broken for another 1,000 years, at least, because of the way in which archetypal energies run, that would just become doctrine. In 200 years, in the 22nd century, that would be the normative religious ritual that everybody would be forced into. And human beings need to be freed now. They need to be freed. So that's not going to happen. So that language is the mirror, and mythology is the mirror for the culture. When spoken, language is symbolized. When spoken, language is symbolized. And once it's symbolized, then written language is possible. On a mythological level, it's like a spoken language. When the meaning is interiorized and brought together symbolically, then it's possible to have a written language. You have to understand this, a very important point. Written languages are recent in the world. The oldest written languages don't go back much beyond 4,000 years, 5,000 years tops. Our species has been around for about 50,000 years, and cognate species for a couple million years. Can you appreciate that? It's like day before yesterday in evolution that there was anything like a written language. A written language is always an indication that somebody has interiorized meaning to the point to where the symbolic self is operative. A written language always shows that that capacity has happened. You know, one of the powerful sayings in Islam is that it is written. Because, like in Islam, the only one who really writes is God. See how powerful that is? The only one who can really write is God. Allah. And if it is written, what are you going to do? You see, it's like that. It's like God's writing is so powerful that our speaking is universes below that in capacity. And one has to watch out for the polarity of that, because it still traps you. Whatever God speaks and whatever we write is a mirror image of that, is the reverse of that, and it's still caught in the same thing. I don't know if you can appreciate it or not, but what I'm saying here is that you don't always know when you're moving towards freedom. There is no way to know with impunity that you are. That's why it doesn't pay to make a beeline. It always pays to circumambulate. It always pays to take your time and move it with a seasonal approach, and then reverse it and move back through the whole process in a different way, just so you can familiarize yourself, because it's a very tricky landscape, very, very tricky landscape. And certain foolishness is to try and shortcut. In a block universe, a Minkowski-type block universe, you would end up in paradox, almost for certain, by any straight line that you would try to take. And that's a very accurate characterization in terms of mid-20th century wisdom. In one of the books in the Bullingen series, The Aurora Consurgence, maybe you've seen it, that volume is bound in red in the Bullingen series in the English translation. In the German original, it was volume 3 of Jung's book on the structures of the self, Aeon, and the structures of the collective unconscious, and Aurora Consurgence was volume 3 of that in the German edition. In the introduction to Aurora Consurgence, which is an alchemical treatise attributed to Thomas Aquinas on his deathbed, Aquinas died when he was 49, and he was just beginning to open up again. His teacher, Albertus Magnus, was one of the greatest alchemists of his time. That's to say, a dealer with the deep self. And Aquinas was just coming into his own, and unfortunately he died too soon. But on his deathbed, he spoke out a vision that he had, and Aurora Consurgence is that vision, the vision of the accurate structure of transformation. And in Jung's introduction to the addition of that, he says, in his farthest out statement possible, he says it is quite possible that if we were able to see astronomically to the farthest ends of the cosmos, the farthest quasi-galactic structures, that one step beyond that, we should see the interior of man's soul in here. I have to use a French word, écouter. Do you know what that means? Écouter means listen. A black hole is a projected demonic image of what really occurs in the deep self as an inner presence, which includes the entire universe, all black holes or whatever else there is included. Notice how the black hole is a perfect symbolic projection of the actual interior structure of the way in which a deep self cosmos actually functions. Unless one can grow not only out of the mythological level to the interior symbolic self, but one has to just in a very parallel way outgrow magic. You have to come out of the magic language just like you came out of the mythological language. And just as the deep self comes out of the mythological language, the person, as an artist of their own life, emerges out of the magical tradition. So that there is like a parallel, but a step up in capacity. It's not like the person is like a junior edition of the self. That's not that at all. The person is a real viable advance on the deep self. But just like you can't throw the masks away, you can't throw the deep self presence away. And it doesn't mean egotistically, in an inflated way, that the person then is some monstrous new kind of a god. It just means that that capacity of the person is extraordinarily mysterious in its capacities. And in this world outstrips the self in terms of actual ability to transform this physical universe. The transformation happens when the deep self and the person are polarized and they exchange positions. instead of the person being the spirit Mercurius for the deep self becomes the spirit Mercurius for the person. Then when that person wishes to transform, brings the deep self in as a spirit, as his or her spirit Mercurius to this situation. You can see how arcane the ecology is and how difficult it is to see it right. How fluid and mobile every aspect of this condition is, and how difficult it is to talk about it in any kind of an intelligent, reflexive way. The kicker in it is that there is always the possibility of inflation through misunderstanding, always. So that the traditional mode instituted by Jesus, incidentally, was to make the person in their viability, in their capacity, a helper of this world. Instead of a king of this world, a helper for the good of this world. In other words, if the mythological image of the divine king had been carried over to the person in that power, everyone would have had the tendency to consider themselves a benevolent tyrant. Instead, a different image was brought in. It's not the divine king. The person in their dimension is not the divine king, but the good shepherd. To take care of others, to take care of even the animals and the trees and the insects and the winds and the tides, to take care of things like a good shepherd would, to care for this world. So that the person who has so much capacity and power that even the deep self is but their helper in this, have that orientation and that structural capacity that what they do is that they help others. They become helpers. I love Ruth Montgomery's phrase, companions along the way. Companions along the way. It's a beautiful phrase. And you can see that, we need a break. You can see that we need a break. Let me just see, you know who you are, I'm glad. Let me just see a show of hands. How many of you have access to a volume of Alchemical Studies? Most of you? Do you? I'm sorry it's so much in paperback. I didn't realize it was $17.50 in paperback. But then, you know, in this world, there's only so much you can really spend money effectively on. And I think your self-development is worth $17.50, even with tax included on top of it. I want to remind you about the music. Because I'm writing two books at the same time and lecturing every other day, I have a lot to keep up. But I want to remind you that there are musical keys to this sequence. And for magic, the musical key is Mozart's magic flute. The whole thing. You need to have the whole thing. And I have a couple of different copies here, and try sometime at least to listen twice to it, to the opera. Is there a part that would be really important? In terms of today's lecture, I would review the parts where Papageno is in the play. He's the Spiritus Mercurius in that. And when the action of the magic flute comes to a wholesomeness, a fullness, something has to be done with Papageno. The only thing that can be done in Mozart, because he was just excellent and he was like very truthful in feeling, he was like a yogi of feeling, he felt that there should be a Papageno, to go with the Papageno. And that they both recognize each other's crazy birdness and hit it off on that score. Like that. And Mozart, as usual, is very trustworthy in that regard. So, Der Zauberflöge, the magic flute for magic. We didn't get to the interval between symbol and magic. That musical piece was Sibelius's Finlandia. And I got somewhat distracted because Mr. Hall's writing a book on the adepts of the Norse and the Finnish traditions, and I was making selections of Sibelius for him. He hadn't heard them for a long, long time, 40 or 50 years. And so I was making selections from Sibelius for him. Sibelius illustrated the Kalevala in music. And it slipped my mind at the time that I should have also made Finlandia, a record of it, a cassette of it for you here. So the interval between symbol and magic was Finlandia. Why Sibelius's Finlandia? Because it has a slow, measured emergence of a sense of grandeur, but that the grandeur is definitely conditioned by the musical unfolding pace. That is to say, when you first hear it, it has a determinedness to it. And if you're not used to Sibelius, you can think of yourself as a very heavy Scandinavian determinedness. But when you get acquainted with it, the determinedness is to unfold completely. And that's the excellence. That's why Finlandia is, I think, the national song of Finland. It's the character of that people who have had to fight their way to their own existence. And so Finlandia is excellent because the emergence from the symbolic interior into that magical realm where psychic energy is loose and wild takes that kind of a determined measureness to bloom. And the person, the art of the person, the art of person making, the alchemical art, the mystical art, is to have your person bloom. And it takes a real determinedness to do that. That doesn't just happen. You would think that being a person is a natural accomplishment. It is not. The resistances are more powerful. It takes a conscious decision, and it takes a concerted effort consciously for that to happen. Man has to help nature there. Nature isn't strong enough to blossom into a person in its usual way. This is why a person is so precious. Anybody who has ever come to be has struggled to help make themselves. And we lose sight of it, but someone like Lincoln, for instance, when he says that this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, is speaking of people in the sense that they are their own persons who have struggled to be, and they all have their right, and a government of and for and by those persons must not perish from this earth. It's not that some nationalistic entity is so inflatedly precious that it should not be let go of, but that the achievement of a government so constituted that it's of the people, by the people, for the people, that must not perish from the earth. That is like a flower of civilization, hard won through thousands of years of struggle. And it's that kind of a vision which is extremely important. One of the few people to hear Lincoln's words with fullness was the young Walt Whitman. And Walt Whitman's cosmic vision of himself is really that that person taking that full self-energy and blossoming. And if you look at the editions of Leaves of Grass before the Gettysburg Address and after, you can see what a transformation. He went from being a mythologically inspired poet writing somewhat unconsciously to being a very conscious human being who knew what he wanted to say, and he said it all. He took off all the clothes of this world and said, I have the garment of man in his full person. And if you think my nudity in this dimension is profane, look to yourself. It is like that. I can get off on it. Huh? Here's the music, and you can do it for yourself. I want to give you a paragraph from. This is the first book written by a very famous Greek scholar, F. M. Cornford. This is called Thucydides Myth Historicus, and Cornford at this time was a young man who had just. He'd apprenticed himself to Jane Ellen Harrison, who was just a magnificent human being around the 1890s and the 1910s. She and Sir George Fraser, James George Fraser, and a number of other individuals at the same time really were a very powerful group of people, quite conscious. And Jane Ellen Harrison was so masterful as a human being, mature human being, that Cornford, as her student, understood from her example how to go back and how to read classical civilization. Cornford later on wrote the great commentaries in Plato's Timaeus and on the Parmenides and the Theaetetus, all the difficult dialogues that the Victorians had let go. Plato doesn't know what he's talking about. It's too confused, they said. And Cornford is the one who really brought it out and said, well, looks like Plato was really grown up after all and knew what he was talking about. Well, his first book was on Thucydides, on the way in which a human being emerges from myth into history. The only figure who is real in history is the person. Who uses language is not subsumed under language, but who uses language to move. And that movement, the record of that is what history is. The movement of such persons, what they do. He writes this, thinking of his teacher, Jane Ellen Harrison, and he's trying to write how the emergence of the person from the mythological horizon of language in ancient Greece was highlighted by the way in which tragic drama yielded the great actor. And he writes this. We must first attempt to describe the structure of Aeschylean tragedy. That's tragedy. Aeschylus was the first of the Greek tragedians. Aeschylus looked like an eagle, a large hooked nose and a kind of a balding head and very piercing eyes. His neck was kind of long, and when he looked sort of at the side like that. We must first attempt to describe the structure of Aeschylean tragedy. In order to understand it, we must try to imagine a yet more primitive stage in the development of the drama than any represented in extant Greek literature, a stage which the earliest of Aeschylus's plays has already left some way behind. A glance at the development of modern drama might help us. Certain features which survived in Greek tragedy suggest that we should look back to a type somewhat resembling the medieval mystery play and some of the earliest modern dramas such as Everyman, which are like the mystery play in being religious performances and then the element of allegorical abstraction. Their effect, due in part to each of these features, may be described as symbolic. Everyman is a sermon made visible. Everyman is a medieval play from about the 12th century. To watch it is like watching the pastime called living chess, in which the pieces are men and women, but the man who is dressed like a bishop is nothing more than a chess man who happens to be automatic. He has not the episcopal character. His dress is a disguise with nothing behind it. His words, if he spoke, would be the speech of a parrot. And so it is with the play Everyman. The persons are not persons at all, but personae, masks, symbols, the vehicles of abstract ideas. They do not exist and could not be conceived as existing in real space and time. They have no human characters, no inward motifs, no life of their own. Every man, as his name is meant to show, is in fact not a man, but man the universal, as a mythological image. The main development of modern drama shows, in one of its aspects, the process by which this symbolic method gives way to the realistic. The self is symbolic, nonetheless real, but the person is realistic, nonetheless symbolic. The process consists in the gradual filling in of the human being behind the mask till the humanity is sufficiently concrete and vital to burst the shell and step forth in solid flesh and blood. The symbol comes to contain a type of character, a type of character, archetype. The creature now has an independent status and behavior of their own. Every gesture and every word would be such as would be used by an ordinary human being with a given character in a given situation. Once created, the personality is an original center. It cannot be made to do what someone else please, or to utter someone else's thoughts. In some such terms as these, a modern novelist or a modern playwright would speak of his characters, and it is thus that they appear to us. That is to say, once a person emerges, you can't manipulate them. Then you have to consult them. And they will do what they choose. They will do what they decide. And so you have to be able to disclose, if you want to persuade them, a language which shows that you're cognizant of the structure of feeling tone presentation, which they will judge on a structural basis, an understanding of what it's for, its purposes, of what actually it is. Now you can see that in this mode, it's very difficult to have a hierarchical structure with one person in charge at the top, because the more persons that you have, the more they are like, well, Socrates said that if there were a whole room full of me, we would never get anything done. It was his comic way of saying. A democracy is a government of such people. It's the form, it's the only form, it is in fact the form by which such a population of emerged persons can effectively work. But you can see that it's very difficult because it presupposes that there are persons in the first place. It presupposes a maturation process which is sufficiently in place, an educational system, which engenders and sustains and maintains this population, which are then capable of instituting a democratic process among themselves. In fact, democracy is the only process that actually would work given a population of original, independent persons. They're all equal in this sense. Notice that this is not a political idea. It is, in fact, a structure of reality, psychological reality. To misinterpret it as merely a political idea is already the language of a projected self whispering. It's already demonic. It's already the complications which stop the maturation process. Now, in terms of actual history in this country, the education process was stopped in the First World War. Soon after the First World War, 1919. Before 1919, there was an educational process in effect, and not so unconscious as you would suppose, which was responsible for maintaining a population which could mature to the point that they would participate in this kind of a process. In 1919, that whole emphasis was changed and knocked out. And one of the reasons why it was able to do that is that the person in charge at that time, President Wilson, was in pretty dire psychological straits at that time. Wilson was a very capable man, but he'd become broken by the war. We have not had, for 70 years now, an educational process which matures human beings. Now, 70 years, generally 20 years would be a generation. So you can see that we're running up to almost four generations now where there has been no population. It's getting to a point, a breaking point, to where one wouldn't remember anyway. That is to say, the democratic processes would be so changed and skewed by the, quote, necessary operating conditions, which are, the alternative is always a regression to a hierarchical stage. Feudal blocks under the umbrella of a royal mastery. It's that kind of thing. That's what the regression would be. This, in fact, happened in classical Greece. The Athenian democracy broke, not because of our condition, because there wasn't a population educated to it, but because it was too new, there weren't enough people in the first place to sustain it. It worked as long as that generation which had understood it and engendered it were alive, the generation of Socrates and Thucydides and Herodotus Plato's father, Ariston, as long as that generation were alive, Sophocles, they understood, but they couldn't pass it on. And so the democratic moment lasted just one generation, two if you want to stretch it. And then it broke. And of course the way that it broke classically in Greece is that the energy was all projected into a demonic polar image, and the demonic polar image was the closest thing to the Athenians, who were the Greeks just over the hills from them, the Spartans. And so a cold war between the Spartan League and the Athenian League led to a bankrupting of both. And within a couple of generations, Sparta was nothing more than a village, and Athens was nothing more than a university town. They bled out their power. They bled out their conditions. I introduce all of this so that you can understand that we're not dealing with psychological isms. We're dealing with, in the best sense, real life situations, real historical situations, which are here for us personally and here for us also in our own country's terms. Quite a crucial time, actually. The key to it all is to have the spiritual courage to, like in Sibelius's Finlandia, to continue to unfold and be your own person. That is the, as Frank Lloyd Wright would say, that's the center line on which the whole architecture, whatever it's going to be, is based. And so your effort is well advised, I think, to keep unfolding, keep that opening process. But understand that you're not opening into ambiguity. You're not opening into quandary. You're opening into your person. That's who must emerge. That's who will emerge. But that the fount out of which that person comes is the deep self, the symbolic self. That though your first experiences with it may seem that it's abstracted, a tranquil condition that has nothing to do with the world, it in fact is a fresh spring in this world. Its tranquility is in this world. And out of that fount, your confidence as a person will come, will be there. That tranquility does not vanish in the person. It doesn't just exist in the quiet of some kind of contemplative prayer. It carries and expresses in a person's life. It could be in your life. And that is where it needs to be. So it needs to be brought out in that sense. Most of you have been here long enough that you remember the images of the witch. Remember in the mythological section. And if some of you who weren't there, you can make Xerox copies of yourself. The witch is a projected soul image thrown out. And just like the devil, the witch, is that projected anima. And of course, if it's projected on your mother or on your wife or on yourself, you take appropriate action. So keep in mind that all of the materials that we're doing save, because it has its place. And when it comes time for us to do history, later on this year, this autumn, we'll start in July, this summer. When we do history, we'll take all of this material that we've had, all this materia, and review it all in its happening, in its chronological form. And if you have a stuffed portfolio at that time, And you have your own memory of things. You have the cassettes, which record it, the chance to talk to each other. At that time, in a reflexive way, you will understand clearer the shape of your own person. It's rare that someone who emerges, or in our metaphor, who blossoms as a person, understands themselves. They understand what they're doing. They understand who they are. But it's only in a historical memory, reflexive way, that one sees oneself actually in this world, how one is in this world. Not just in your own quality of presence. The old saying is how you fit in, which is a little inappropriate, but carries the message. And you see objectively yourself